Thanks, Bruno, for inviting me to give the talk and inviting me to the workshop, and thanks to the organizers. So actually, I'm going to talk a bit about convection in two senses. I was going to talk more about Rayleigh-Bernard flow, which is just you have a hot plate, a cold plate, and then you begin to drive the flow by temperature difference, and you have stuff going on here. But I know Jörg is going to talk about it on Friday, so I'm going to talk also quite a bit about Taylor-Couette flow. I realize I didn't have much more to say about Taylor-Couette and about Rayleigh-Bernard, but they're very similar systems, and they're both linearly unstable. And in this case, you have basically transport of angular momentum, and you have, well, two cylinders which rotate differently. So starting by Taylor-Couette, you basically have four parameters. You have two geometric parameters. One radius ratio gives you a measure of the curvature of the system. An aspect ratio gives you a measure of how tall, or basically in computation, is how large your computational box is. You have two driving parameters, which are the two Reynolds numbers of the cylinders. You can usually write this as a shear plus a solid body rotation, which is what you have here. It's one Reynolds number minus the other one with factors. If you're at low Reynolds number, you have this parameter space by Anderegger. Might be familiar to some of you. You have a lot going on. You have like spiral turbulence, wavy vortices, turbulent Taylor vortices, all kinds of different solutions to this problem. What I want to focus a bit more at the start is what happens when you start to transition to turbulence. Basically, you have a laminar flow here. You begin to rotate the inner cylinder, you increase the Reynolds number. You form these sort of cells or Taylor structures, which are really fixed in time. You can visualize them using a kaleidoscope. You rotate harder, and you have this waviness on top of the cylinder. You rotate even harder, you have this turbulence popping up. And you rotate even harder, you have suddenly a featureless turbulence. And this was at Reynolds 10 to the 5 at one radius ratio of 7.14. However, some experiments that were performed in 20, they played a bit around, same radius number, same Reynolds shear, 10 to the 6, they played a bit around with the rotation parameters. And they recovered a signature of large-scale signatures. This is a cut at a constant radius, so it's like unwrapping the cylinder. And if you look at the color code, this angular velocity, and you see it, not only do you have like very marked signatures, but you also can get different signatures depending on how you get to the same point.
So what's the difference between the top and the bottom?
So the top and the bottom, there depends just how you start the cylinders. You can get like four pairs or two pairs, essentially. But you get very large. You get my point here is more. You have marked scale structures. I will go more a bit about the multiplicity of states later.
Is there some averaging going on, or is this a snapshot?
This, I think, is a snapshot. But I will show you that you can recover all this in that. The point was they found some conflicting evidence to the previous evidence. This is actually a DNS simulation. This is something I did. So here, what you're doing is you're taking a cut of the cylinder like this. Your color code red to blue. This is azimuthal velocity. You see that you have a very marked scale structure. I mean, this is turbulent, Reynolds 10 to the 5, but you still have some very marked patterns. Why is this happening? If you average in time and in azimuth, you get this pattern comes up. And like I say, even if you're going up to Reynolds 10 to the 5, you seem to have a very fixed thing. So this was bothering us, and the first part
So
of the
we talk
talk.
about, is that picture true aspect ratio?
Yeah, two aspect ratio.
So that's a very different aspect ratio compared to what you saw previously, right?
Yeah, but I will show. And this, the first part, 10 minutes, is about all the things we did to try to get rid of this and how none of it worked, but that's a spoiler. The first thing we did was to put some axial flow through this. So we put some pressure gradient on this direction. But you see that you still have some, this thing here is still existing, and this thing here is still existing. You're moving it slowly up because you put in some pressure gradients. But you still have it. And if you look at the axial correlations, radial velocity at the mid-gap, you see almost perfect signature of a large-scale structure. As the move of velocity shows some structure, but not so much. The thing about these rolls, right? You have this thing here. So once you have a pipe or a plane coed, you have sort of a boundary layer that extends way into the flow. Look here, you can really separate the system. This is why I think Taylor coed looks way more like Rayleigh-Bernard, a place where you have a well-mixed interior and two boundary layers, and it looks like plain coed. If you look at the velocity profile, you have inner and outer boundary layers, and the bulk where the velocity is mixed very well. Even if you have these structures, if you average it out, you get very horizontal. If you look at a Rayleigh-Bernard flow, you will get the temperature looks like this, a mean temperature in the middle and a hot plate and a cold plate.
What are the top and bottom boundary conditions?
This is periodic for now.
Excuse me. Related to periodicity, when you were averaging in time, you said the rolls were persistent.
Yes.
But because it's completely insensitive to,
It should be, but they are fixed axially. This is what's been bothering me for the last year and a half. And this is why I want to show all the different things we did to try to get rid of. Because you should assume a symmetry, and that's why I think this problem is so interesting, but it doesn't. And they are fixed there. I mean, of course, you can translate them using artificially in the DNS. You know, you mess up your data. So you translate it, you recover, they stay at the same place you put them at.
Yes.
I mean, in this condition, we put them here just by accident, but you can play with the noise and everything. The position is, well, not random, it depends on your noise, but it always tends to be fixed.
There is some symmetry breaking in.
So they're not ergodic?
No.
In the sense that the phase doesn't drift randomly?
No. At least for...
That's a very, very long time.
Well, I've done up to... I'll show you later. Because...
are you rotating...
This is only the inner cylinder rotation.
Just the inner cylinder.
I start with this because the inner cylinder is what gives you this kind of things. I'll later show a bit of other things going on. So if you look at your boundary layers, you usually have your logarithmic profile. You go up to Reynolds tau 4000. This is omega zero, only rotating the inner one. You see your log layer, but this log layer is basically interrupted very abruptly by this bulk, which is essentially your well-mixed interior. If you look at your logarithmic diagnostic function, which tells you how logarithmic things are, essentially, you see you have this small S profile here going up, even at the highest Reynolds number. This is equivalent to Reynolds tau 4000. This is the one with the axial flow I was showing. And this compares pretty much to the channels of Javier and Adrián, that you see this S thing. However, they do see some more flat here at Reynolds tau 4050. My Reynolds tau 450 is more or less equivalent to the Reynolds tau 550, which means it's way harder in Taylor Qued to get a nice log layer due to all the mixing in the bulk. Somebody looks like they had a question? No. Can plot this profile against other flows, and you do see that for Reynolds tau 2000, you tend to fall on the same von Karman line. There's maybe a bit of a difference. But essentially, you do get this bending, which makes it way different. So if the black is a Taylor Qued line, it goes down this S structure way earlier than all other flows. You have a zero pressure gradient boundary layer, you have a plain Qued, you have a channel, and you have a pipe. And all of them follow more or less the same thing, but the Taylor Qued again drops down. So the other thing is like, okay, can you see this log layer behavior in other statistics? We found an overlap layer, for those of you who are familiar. So once you plot this in outer units, and you have the free increasing Reynolds tau here, you see that these fluctuations collapse in outer units here between, this is basically, here is the mid gap. So again, they're not supposed to collapse here, but in the low layer, they're collapsing very nicely. And if you look at not only azimuthal or spanwise fluctuations, but also in the axial fluctuations, you get a very nice collapse. You don't get them in the wall normal fluctuations because your Ari tau is too small. Maybe when you increase, maybe not, but definitely the Ari tau is too small to see anything here. So we are sort of okay. We have some of the Taylor Qued problem has some of the characteristics of turbulence, some of other canonical flows. But again, look inside the boundary layers. This is y plus equals 15. And here you're showing azimuthal velocity, so the streaks. And you see that this area is way lighter than this area. So you see a very strong impact of a large scale structure. Again, Reynolds 10 to the 5, so your structures are small, but you have some sort of self-organization here. You can look at the spectra, more or less what you expect. The spectra peaks at the very low wavelengths. that means peaks for very large structures. And the funny part of here, not only peaks for azimuthal velocity, which is the same as you get in channels and Planckwedt, but the spectra also peaks for the axial spectra also peaks for the radial velocity. And this is something that you don't get for channels or Planckwedt, because you usually have this mountain which corresponds to where transport is at large-scale streaks. But the peak for transport in this system is very markedly at axisymmetry and at your first wavelength corresponding to the transport of the rolls. And this is very different from both, well, basically channel and Planckwedt. So, answering the questions before, yes, this is a small domain. This green one was at some point we got asked to make a bigger domain. This blue one was at some point we got asked to make an even bigger domain. So now we're talking, usually in Taylor Quet you use the entire gap and not the half gap. So if you go here from 0 to 8, this usually means 0 to 16 in half gap units. And here it's more or less 0 to 12. Again, azimuthal velocity at the mid gap, very structured patterns. In high, low, high, low, high, low, high, low. Here you have three pairs of rows. Take a cut, azimuthal, this looks like this. High, low, high, low, high, low, all these rows. By the way, I know I use different color maps. I actually have a talk on color maps. I should give some time. You look at the spectra, again, of the axial spectra of azimuthal velocity. Very marked peaks associated to the wavelength of the rolls. Here it's actually 15 orders of magnitude, so you don't see it so much. But these peaks are 2 or 3 orders of magnitude higher than the non-peaks. And this is the peak corresponding to the wavelength of the rolls. This is Reynolds 3 × 10⁴, RE tau of 550, so we're not talking of not very turbulent stuff here. You average it out, again you get this large.
So what did you say RE tau was again?
550. I mean, it's not large, but it's still, I mean, for the small boxes we went up to 4,000 and we see it at 4,000, so. Again, people were a bit hesitant to believe this, even larger boxes. This is 21 pi in half gaps times 2 times 9 pi. Nobody has done 9 pi in a spanwise direction in any flow. Still, 7 pairs of rolls, so 14, very nicely. High, low, high, low, high, low, high, low, high, low. Averaging time, 29. Frictional time units comes to 5 or 10% of a viscous time. You can look at the velocity. It fluctuates against a point. You can look at the running average of velocity. You can look at many things. There is a small fluctuation at the frictional scale, but still it remains there. This is a little smaller RE tau, 240.
I mean, you've adjusted the length so that you would always get sort of another set of pairs in there. What happens if you take a length which is sort of in between? So that rather than having, 7 pairs, you would have 6 and 9 pairs.
You will get 6 pairs just larger. This is what I'm going to show you now. You can get different number of pairs for the same box. Okay. You get either 2 pairs or 3 pairs, depending on how you start up and the initial conditions you use. And these are, like I said, these are non-ergodic. You can run this simulation for a very long time and you will still get 3 pairs or 2 pairs. Reynolds inner, 3 times 4 times 10 to the 4. This is RE tau of 550 again.
I'll keep going. I was
going to
wait till you finish.
Yeah, and RE tau 550, this you can run for a long time. Again, you get 2 or 3.
So you haven't said anything about centrifugal instability.
Sorry?
This is a very different mechanism that isn't present in all the other canonical.
Yeah, I will come to that later.
Okay, that's your punchline.
Pardon not the spot. Punchline. I said this is a lot of assorted ideas I've been putting together in the last 2 days, just to get people an impression of why I'm so bothered by this, essentially. And yeah.
How do you start your simulations?
Oh, so you basically, I start them in very different ways. Depending on how you start them, you get different states. So to get this one, what I did was I resampled one which was a larger simulation. Sorry, this one. I resampled one which was up to 8 or 9, resampled it down to 7, and that's how I got this one. But this is stable. I mean, I'm running this for 20, 30 frictional time units, and they still remain there. And you can use white noise, you can use colored noise, like very characteristic spectra. That depends a lot. I mean, that's also what they see in experiments. Depending on how you start up or you do it, you get very, very marked states with very different characteristics. And this is just a nice video to show you. So these are the two simulations from before inside the boundary layer. And here you're seeing the streaks. You're looking at the spanwise velocity. This is not that nice. But here you really see the order. I mean, instead of seeing the 45 or the degrees mixed, you see that all those streaks have the same angle here, and they have the opposite angle here. And the rolls would be coming out of here. So the rolls would be looking like this. 2 and 3. And you can run this for a long time. This video runs for 1 minute and a half or something. And you see the same thing, quite a large box. Again, this is 14 half, sorry, this is the spanwise 14 width. This is more like 28 or something like this. And if you look at your boundary layers, so the red and the blue are the two different states for gamma equals 7. They are very different. If you take one roll instead of, this has the same roll wavelength, 2.3. So essentially, this is this simulation divided by 3. You get the same statistics. However, for the same computational box, you get different statistics depending on your initial conditions, which is, again, a puzzling phenomenon. This is R-E-tau 550. Something that Polar does less is when you go to R-E-tau 1400, this is one single roll, but you have 3 different wavelengths, 2, 3, and 4. This is your log law. They seem to collapse better on one another.
Does your averaging time change this at all?
No. I mean, say you can do, usually free frictional time units gets you good convergence on first order statistics, especially streamwise means. Going up to 10, 20, get better fluctuations, but not better means. So here starts a bit the fun part, which we started to play around with this. So one of the things we did was to add riblets to the inner and the outer cylinder, see what's the effect on the flow. You see here you have no riblets, and you're going up in riblet size. Essentially, you're keeping them like 45 degrees. And you see, now you're like sort of nucleating these plumes at the triangle tips. Because once you add these things, this sort of acts like a lightning rod for the nucleation of instabilities. Take the simulation. I mean, this one looks like this inside the boundary layer. Nope. Look at this one. Very clear stripes. You expect, we might be onto something. But no. You look at the correlation between axial velocity and basically, this is a measure of the transport. It's radial velocity times angular velocity. So it gives you an idea of how much torque or momentum is being transported. Nope. Very nice rolls here. Maximum here, minimum here. The rolls look like this on this paper. You see some stuff going on here, close to the wall. But no, in the bulk, everything seems to just dissolve. This is very new work. Actually, this video I made yesterday and 2 days ago. What happens if now you suddenly decide to stop the cylinder? So you can do this two ways. You can actually stop the cylinders, or in numerics you can let them go, make both walls free slip and see how the turbulence decays. And this is how it looks like. You have a moment where this disappears. But while it's disappearing, let's play it again. For some time, in a sense, it's still rolling. It's like the Rolling Stones are still rolling after 60 years. I mean, we can't get rid of these things. So if you look at actually the energy of the wind, this is in viscous time units. This is the energy of the wind, 12 times 2. For the first amount of time, this is really a straight line. And this corresponds to maybe 10 or 20 turnover times. This is not like 2 points on your simulation, which means you have a straight line. This is actually there for, 10% of the frictional time, maybe? Before, like, say, the energy of the boundary layers is drained and you can essentially begin to decay. And this happens both if you no-slip or you free-slip suddenly the cylinders. So going back to Mike's question, this is basically centripetal instability. So at some point, we spent a lot of time simulating all the different parameters you could get with Taylor quads. This is 1/rho, which is a rotation ratio in a sense. So 0 is pureness in the rotation. And you see that some areas you don't have rolls, some areas you have rolls only at one part. And also when you play with the curvature, you can have rolls or no rolls, even for pureness in the rotation. For example, for curvature, eta equals 1 is Planck wet. Eta equals 0, basically, you have a straw rotating a swimming pool. If you go just to 0.5, you see absolutely no trace of these rolls. But for eta 909, which is very close to Planck wet, with still having a centrifugal stability, you see this very marked thing. But again, of course, it depends how you rotate the cylinders. Here is co-rotating cylinders, still centrifugally stable, but you don't have large-scale rolls. This is what we call a mild counter-rotation. So you do have a part which is positive and negative, so you do have a zero in the middle. However, if this is negative, if this is not very strong, you do get rolls which occupy the entire space. But if you counter-rotate harder, you see there is only rolls at a certain part.
Do you
have
any data for just
outer-cylinder
rotation?
Yes, it's
coming. Is it all same Rossby numbers?
No, these are, mu is basically, you can express it as a Rossby number. It's the same shear, different Rossby.
Okay.
So this is how it looks like when you have an outer cylinder which is counter-rotating. Looks very bursty and bumpy. And the inner cylinder you have very, again, here and here are the points where, if you go back to here, here and here, where plumes tend to accumulate, this part is stable. You have a very marked division between both areas. Bruno and Hannes Brugmann spent some time doing this, analyzing this. They looked at the torque at the inner and the outer cylinder. You see, the torque at the inner cylinder in a case like the previous one is very, I mean, the fluctuations are not very large, because, I mean, while the fluctuations at the outer cylinder become quite big compared to fluctuations at the inner cylinder. And they derived a theory which predicts quite well, actually, when this intermittent behavior starts at the outer cylinder. And just to tell you, we are doing some simulations here with the Cottbus people, and it also marches really well, just so you know.
Just to be clear, the horizontal axis in figure A is what?
Sorry?
In the left one.
This is the torque time at the cylinders.
As a function of time.
As a function of time, yes.
Intercellular rotation only?
No, this is a case similar to this one, where you have where you have a very intermittent behavior at the outer cylinder. Yep. If you do inner cylinder rotation, they both look like this. The moment you have this onset of, let's say, stability bursts, then this looks very different, which is, yeah, this.
What's the time scale of these oscillations?
The time scale of these oscillations? I don't know. Maybe Bruno can answer.
You're asking for the
time
scale?
Yeah, what sets it?
I don't know.
Answering your question, we go for pure outer cylinder rotation. So you think you can start rotating more and more and more and more the outer cylinder, and now it all looks completely bursty. And this flow looks very different from the initial flow we had. So purple, this is again angular momentum as a function of radii. Purple is the inner cylinder rotation, extremely well mixed, flat interior. Blue, red, and yellow are three different Reynolds numbers for the outer cylinder, but you have a very different picture. And the black squares were experiments from Yi and Buring, which were really nice. No, sorry, Buring and Swarovski. It's really nice to match them. The boundary layers look completely different. I mean, remember that these plots used to bend downwards to become flat for inner cylinder rotation, but for outer cylinder rotation now they bend upwards. And Planck wet, the black line is at the middle, which is following nicely the log line. So it seems the system is doing weird things. And if you look at the PDF for transport, again, this is the correlation of radial velocity and angular velocity, so it gives you an idea of how much torque is being transported. The pureness in the rotation is the blue line. You have a very sharp peak here associated to these plumes I was showing before. The outer cylinder rotation, well, it's definitely super Gaussian. This orange line is a Gaussian model. So it's completely different physics just by deciding which cylinder you rotate. And the last thing I'll say about this is that the spectra now, the rate of velocity at the walls, the axial spectra, now looks like other flows. So you no longer have this weird peak at the we used to have. Now it just looks like a nice energy maximum at the length scale of the streaks. Just a few words about the last regime. So what we did before is we took a point here, periodicity and rotation, and we started rotating the outer cylinder stronger and stronger and stronger until it became all counter rotation. You can begin to co-rotate until you cross this line, which is the linear stability line. But then you can begin to rotate this cylinder the same direction until you eventually reach solid body rotation. Between these two lines, there is this gray region, which is of relevance to astrophysical flows. But the very puzzling part is you have a opposing gradients of angular momentum and angular velocity. And, well, basically, Mark did some simulations some time ago where he tried to reproduce some experiments and tried to understand if the source of turbulence they saw in those experiments were the boundary conditions, or do you actually see turbulence in the flow? And he said, no, it's actually the boundary conditions. At some point, what I did is, was to take a fully turbulent place and put it directly in this regime and see how it actually turbulence decays to zero. So if you let it go long enough in this regime, at least up to 10 to the 5 Reynolds, which is quite a large regime, what, starting with initial turbulent conditions, you go to a laminar flow. So a summary of this part, we have a very rich parameter space. You have many different scenarios. Linearly unstable Taylor Couette flow looks very different from other things. Well, linearly stable, well, you do have some things which look similar to plane Couette and pipe flow, but not all of them. And this quasi-Kepler regime, which is a big question mark of what's going on here. It's a regime where you don't have turbulence. I think Anna will spend some years trying to answer that. So, really, Bernard. This system is similar in the sense that you have a linear instability. You're basically heating up fluid here. It's cold here, so this tends to fall, this tends to rise. You have several control parameters. Rayleigh number gives you an idea of how hard you're driving the turbulence. Randall number gives you of how viscous the fluid is compared to how heat conductive is a parameter of the fluid. And Rossby number is if you want to add some sort of rotation in this direction. So you start turning around the whole thing like this. Your usual thing you measure is Nusselt number, which is a measure of how much heat are you actually transporting from one plate to the other compared to how much heat would normally be conducted. Now comes the moment for nice videos. Well, so this is one of the simulations we did. You can see the plumes forming here very close to the boundary layers. And they go up. They all go up around this area of the flow.
What's the isosurface?
This is not really an isosurface. It's a visualization. So you set the transparency depending on your temperature, and what you actually do is you set the mean fluid to not be visible, but then you do some ray casting. It's a bit elaborate, but essentially blue is called, because you see the blue has different colors, so it's also changing color depending on. And red is hot, then yellowish is not so hot. But the main point I want to make here is that this is falling here. And if you let it go for a long time, it will keep on falling here. And this is going up here. Again, you can go to very large boxes. This is now 32 times 32. This is done recently by Richard Stevens and Alexander Blass. You see, there's points of where the plumes are upwelling. There are always certain points where they tend to go up. And they seem to self-organize in these structures. I say this is quite a, you can see this is quite a long period of time. I can play it again. And they've also run simulations at 64 times 64, and they do still see these structures. So at this point, red is hot, blue is cold. Sorry, this is temperature essentially.
And your timing
So you take a free fall velocity, which is square root of g beta or delta. Essentially, all your velocities are of this order if you're at final number equals 1. So now I should have like 10 minutes. I'm going to talk a bit about what the things we did to try to control the structures also in Rayleigh-Benard, not go into a lot of detail. the first things we tried was in 2D. We tried to modify the sidewalls. So these plates are no-slip plates. And depending on whether you have periodic sidewalls, no-slip sidewalls, or stress-free sidewalls, you get a very different picture. These are relatively thin cells. So this is 1/3 of the height. If you do no-slip sidewalls, you basically end up with several rolls stacked on top of each other. If you do stress-free, the rolls disappear completely. But they now the plumes now attach to these stress-free walls, and they go like this. And you essentially have very large-scale circulation like this. And this becomes essentially a mean temperature, 0.5. The periodic case is more interesting because if you remember, go back to the first week, Wally was presenting some minimal solutions of these things in very reduced domains. What you actually do if you run a periodic simulation in a very small box is, this is your Nusselt number. You essentially accumulate energy and the box starts to burst at certain time intervals. This is Rayleigh 10 to the 8. If you increase your Rayleigh number, you stop the bursting. But you do need some sort of minimal box. Here is a PDF of the time it takes between bursts. So the time between bursts at 70 and, sorry, Rayleigh 10 to the 7 and Rayleigh 10 to the 8 actually increased. And this reflects,
So from 10 to the 7 to 10 to the 8, it increases.
Yes.
But somehow at 10 to the 11,
it goes back. I think it once you increase the Rayleigh number beyond a certain point, you can actually sustain turbulence in this place.
But you fix your the box with the same in those?
Yeah, the box is the same in these two. The thing is, like, for some point, it increases the time of it takes to burst. But then once your box is, so when your Rayleigh number is large enough and your structures become small enough, they no longer burst. And if you look at the transport, the Nusselt number against your gamma, which is your periodic ratio, you see that this is like your minimal box to sustain turbulence. And this box becomes smaller with increasing Reynolds number. But if you don't have that box, your Nusselt number is way smaller than what you, so your transport is way smaller than what you normally see. And this plot actually shows normalized by a period-free box, so that it tends to oscillate more or less around the same, around one, goes up or down, but not too much. Some other things which people have done, this is a very interesting result. So now you still have, you have periodic boundary conditions on the sides. Now you make your plates free slip. For Rayleigh 10 to the 6, you have a very clean roll structure. If you increase your Rayleigh number, what happens is these things start to move this way, and the top begins to move another way. And you reduce your transport by a factor 4 or 5. This is what you call zonal flow. And again, you go back to bursting behavior. But the strange thing here is that you go to bursting behavior once you increase the driving. And you can look at it, and there is some sort of hysteresis of whether you go there or not. But essentially, for very high Rayleigh numbers, you always end up in this state if you have free slip here and periodic here. But unfortunately, that state is more a characteristic of 2D-ness than it is. In 3D, if you play with no slip and free slip conditions at the plates, you see basically, well, you see difference, but you have the same flow.
If you do this in rotating 3D,
I know, David Golovkin.
It goes back again. David Golovkin.
Yeah, I know the David Golovkin, but you do have to, the flow looks, it's quasi, you can argue. Work. Yeah, you do need to introduce additional things. Another thing we did, this is more like.
Do you have a different phase diagram? Go back to these one in the 2D.
Yeah.
Do you have a different phase diagram for the bursting shearing convection and the steady state shearing convection? Do you have anything to add to what?
No, because we did at the same time. So what we added was that we did also asymmetric plates.
I see.
But unfortunately, we did both at the same time, and they presented the same conference, and they published first. But we still did asymmetric plates. This was done by Luca Riferali and Ripesi and some other people. What they did here was to play with the temperature boundary conditions. So they introduced certain adiabatic and conducting patterns at the surface. And what they found out, this is temperature again, they found out that conducting adiabatic, the pattern is not really felt on the bulk. And especially when you go to really high wavelength patterns, they don't see too much. We extended this to 3D, and we did both stripes and checkerboards on the top and on the top plates. We also did stuff on the bottom plate. We did quite a few things, look at the Fourier spectra. But the basic message here is that it doesn't matter what you do, you cannot control these things. by patterning the boundary. I think at that work we also tried different temperature boundary conditions, made some parts hotter, made some parts colder, and there was very little we could do to actually have an effect on the large scale. And Eduardo told me the other day, Eduardo Westphal told me, well, I mean, you should try controlling the mean flow and not controlling the boundaries. And yeah, he's probably right. And just as a few more results before we finish. So this is work actually by Keith, Julia, and Rubio. They saw that rotation, if you strongly rotate around this axis, you get the formation of large-scale structures, but very different ones. Now you have these sort of tornadoes forming. And this rotate like this instead of rotating like this. What is this? We found that this thing depends very critically on the conditions at the plates. So for free, if you simulate the full Navier-Stokes, because they have a constraint model, simulate the full Navier-Stokes with free slips, you do get these structures. If you go to no slip plates, same Reynolds, so same Rayleigh number, same everything, you don't get this structure. So it seems that the plates are quite critical in injecting vorticity or something into these rolls, which break it or not, even at the same Rayleigh number. And just to finish off, well, I know Greg likes asymptotics, so I mean, you'll have this asymptotics, but you also have a few more. And these have barely been explored, actually. So there is a Prandtl number going to infinity asymptotic, which reduces the equations. So basically, you get rid of this nonlinear term. And really, but you have a velocity field, which is actually a slave of your temperature field. But you also have a zero Prandtl number asymptotic. And this one really has not been explored at all, aside from this paper by Olivier Chauval. And I think there's quite a few work to be done exploring the validity of this. And the other thing I'd like to draw your attention to is this very similar problem to Rayleigh-Bernard, which is called internal heating, which basically Rayleigh-Bernard, you have hot plate and cold plate. Internal heating, you can see it as a channel flow equivalent. If this is quet and this is channel, you know, here you heat the whole thing. And I think it's not been very explored because it's very hard to do experimentally, but now in numerics you can do it. And the two things you measure here are both the mean temperature and the fraction of the heat that goes through the top and through the bottom. Because it's not 0.5 once you begin to have turbulence. More heat tends to go out the top than out the bottom. So Erwin, who was my office mate and good friend for quite a few years, and again David Goloskin did some work on this. This is the mean temperature profile. The parabola is your basically your non-turbulent state. They find that this essentially your temperature decreases with increasing Rayleigh number, increasing amount of heat. They see very different physics in 2D, which are the red versus the blue, which is 3D. This is the fraction of heat that leaves the bottom, starts at 0.5 symmetric system, decreases all the way down to 0.2 for 3D, but at 2D you have a sort of minimum. And this is the mean temperature compensated by the Rayleigh number. And again, they see a sort of, I said this one is more similar than this one. This is Rayleigh number dependence, and they did some Prandtl number dependence. And the funny thing about this flow is that this is fully linearly unstable. This is the mixture of stable unstable you had in Taylor Coet. You have one part, if you have hot fluid here and cold fluid here, this is linearly stable. And this hot fluid here, cold fluid here, this is linearly unstable. And if you look at it in a video, it looks something like this. So you see the plumes coming down from here, but this looks very different. This looks, again, a bit more bursty than other things. You see cold and cold, and here what we made transparent was a very hot fluid. So the plumes are falling into here, mixing, but this is stable, so it doesn't want to mix. And I guess it's 12, so I guess it's time to finish. That's it.
Thank you very much. That was a large number of coherent structures. Any of them been calculated and related to exact coherent structures?
No, except by Taylor.
All right.
The case in which you were trying to control Rayleigh-Bernard with a pattern in your...
Yeah.
Okay, I mean, do you try really large patterns?
If you go to the extreme case, yes. I mean, when your pattern is the size of your height, then you do see something. But even by the moment you go even to this four, you know, like a chessboard, or even double like a chessboard, thinking that this is one by one. You don't see it. You look at the spectra. This is a manuscript you're about to submit. You look at the spectra. The spectra shows no signature of the pattern, even the moment you leave the boundary layer, like y plus of 20, you don't see the spectra having a pattern anymore.
I mean, that makes sense. I mean, that's a little like, I mean, when you try to control a channel or a boundary layer,
yeah.
When you try to do it with Riblet, you just touch the near wall region.
Yes, yes.
But then there are all these people now who are trying to control the large scale by having big patterns.
Yeah.
Trying Riblet or something. And there you see something. I mean, you can control the...
But no, I agree, but that's really going extreme. Give me a second.
It works.
No, yeah, I mean, but we want to do by small. Let me see. Let me show you.
Why? I mean, why?
That was my idea back at the time. Now I got frustrated. So if you look at, it should be here. This is the manuscript we're about to submit. So don't record this now. Actually, this has been shown in conferences already. This is the wavelength of the pattern. So increasing here becomes smaller wavelength. This is the Nusselt number. And here we show it normalized by the fully conducting space. Mm-hmm. And you get very close to the Nusselt number of the fully conducting case, even if half your area is conducting. But really 10 to the 7, 10 to the 8, this tends to be quite robust.
But then, I mean, that 10 this there means...
10 means half and half. This is really one pattern.
But that really increases the. I mean, that really changes the Nusselt number.
Yeah, but it's a 2/3, and you can rationalize 2/3 actually.
Anyone questions?
So this just the existence of the large scale flows and the absence of drift, this all reminds me to some extent of the large-scale structure that we see in shear flows and that people have been talking
about. Yeah, the Godley vortices.
About. Plain shear flows, the large-scale structures that Javier was talking about, that Ivan was talking about, but that you might be able to capture, and Carlo was talking about, that you might be able to capture with LES. So if people thought about similar kinds of things here. I mean, so now you still, it's like the turbulent Taylor-Couette flow case, you still have the angular momentum driven instability and then the dissipation, it's not viscous, it's a cascade. Yeah. I'm just curious to what extent people have thought about that idea in this context.
So actually I was thinking of the same idea of Carlo. When I saw Carlo, I was like, I have to do this next.
Okay.
So that's, I have it for 2 weeks, this idea. I'll probably do it. I was finishing off the decay stuff this last month. But definitely, I think I have to go there.
Well, they're different. I mean, these things aren't stable.
I understand. I'm just thinking about sort of general similarities, that you still have the large scale, still have the large scale motions and dissipation. They're just different when you have different Reynolds numbers.
I'll send it to Javier's workshop then to do.
There you go. Yeah. Perfect.
Any more questions?
So any idea how long do you have to compute until you have to run until this thing begins to move? They have to move, you know.
They got to diffuse.
Maybe I can mention a result that we have from the asymptotic section boundary layer. We looked at sort of the vortices that form and identified sort of their wiggling motion sideways. And then there was sort of a random component on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a very slow, sort of unusual effective time units on the order of 10 to the 4, a very slow sideways drift. Sort of turn around. I mean, there was sort of a small, slow, large-scale meandering on top of the random fluctuations. And basically the same can happen in Taylor type flow. That would mean that the times become very long for these structures.
Not sure. I mean, I think I already told Rodolfo, but I remember when I was a student. I was, Tom Coles had a class, experimental class, and we all had to find a bifurcation in his Taylor-Couette experiment, okay? And the experience was you crank the finalito, go away, go away for a couple of days, and then come back if something can happen. And in the meantime, in shorter time scale, nothing happened. It was glacially slow.
Yeah, yeah, but okay. But that's sort of the quicker you're slowing down, that's the application. This is sort of where the plan.
Yeah. This is what they were talking
about. There are, I mean, things going from 7 rows to 5 rows, things like that. I mean, it was not from
laminar to rows. This is something I was saying before. So this is instantaneous velocities in blue, running averages in dark orange, and final averages in yellow. And you see that you do have an oscillation this period. This corresponds more or less to frictional time units. So this is 2 frictional time units. But this should be 0 if there was no asymmetry. And you see that there is still some, I mean, it's very far away from 0.
Okay. So let me close with an announcement and an invitation for this afternoon. A 5-hour invitation of the director, there is wine and cheese. And other than that, I'm not aware of any formal events this afternoon. So in that sense, okay.